the credit quality improvement of our entire portfolio goes up overnight with the elimination of 280E. There are very few REITs out there that have a single catalyst that elevates the credit quality of the entire portfolio upon one action.
This is The Dime. Dive into the cannabis and hemp industry through trends, insights, predictions, and tangents.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of The Dime. I'm Brian Fields, and with me, as always, is Kellen Finney. And this week, we've got a very special guest, President and CEO of NewLake, Anthony Coniglio. Anthony, thanks for taking time. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks so much for having me. Look forward to the conversation.
Looking forward to diving in. Kellen, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Excited to talk to Anthony. NewLake's always been one of my favorite funds out there, and excited to hold the West Coast down. I know that there's some strong New York ties here on the pod today, so I'll hold the West Coast down. But I don't think that there's any loyalty. I think the loyalty is probably on the East Coast for Anthony right now.
For now, yeah, for sure.
I appreciate you setting that up. And Anthony, as we know, right, you and I, East Coast, and Kellen holding it down for the West Coast. And I think for our listeners, maybe unfamiliar about you, can you give a little background about how you got into the cannabis space and then just a quick background on NewLake?
Yes. It was back in 2018. I'd recently sold a business that I was running before NewLake in 2018, was really looking for opportunities that were out in the marketplace that could leverage what I had done previously in different businesses, which was identify underserved markets that had compelling return dynamics that were going through some fundamental change. And we thought we could bring some value and perspective to capitalize on those fundamental changes. And I was introduced to the opportunity. NewLake was not my idea. I was introduced to the opportunity through a friend who had a REIT that was focused on multifamily and started talking about the unique opportunities that were available in this segment of the world that he was looking at, the opportunity to get some above market cap rates, the opportunity to really be one of the first movers in the sector. And it all sounded very compelling. And I kept saying, that sounds interesting. What industry? And then he ultimately said, it's the cannabis industry. And my first reaction, I'm embarrassed to say, was, what do you mean? Like, come on. Now, my background was JP Morgan, Price Waterhouse. And to his credit, this friend said, you're not keeping an open mind. Go do the work. And I did. And I was embarrassed by what I had learned. I had let the narrative that was broadly out there really cloud my view of it. And so after I became educated, then I really started focusing on this business environment and the business opportunity. And it was just tremendously compelling. And so in late 18, we pulled together a small group of people, all shook hands, said, we're going to go do this. And in early 2019, we organized the company. We went out and raised our first round of capital by summer of 2019, $85, $86 million of capital. We used that to start acquiring properties, raise more capital, acquire properties. In early 21, we combined with a like-sized REIT called Green Acreage. We now had over $300 million of assets combined, and we used that as a springboard to the public markets in the summer of 2021, where we raised about $100 million in our IPO. So we're currently traded on the OTC under NLCP as our ticker. We today own 31 properties across 12 states with 12 separate tenants. We have about 1.7 million square feet of rentable space across cultivation and dispensary properties. And that's the quick story on NewLake.
I appreciate that. And I think one of the important parts to highlight is that with challenges like the cannabis industry comes opportunities for businesses to kind of fit those needs. And one of the words thrown around consistently that I'm not so familiar with, but I'd like you to elaborate on, is triple net lease. What does that mean? And in layman's terms, how does that work?
Yes. No, it's a great question, because especially around real estate, you could hear single net, double net, triple net. The essence of triple net is that all of the property's expenses are borne by the tenant. And so you will often say, okay, I'm renting. Maybe people who are watching are renting an apartment and they have to pay their own utilities. It would be a similar type of thing, but what they wouldn't have to pay for is if the window broke or something happened with the roof. Here with triple net, all of the property expenses are borne by the tenant themselves. And so for us, it really looks more like a financing transaction. It really looks more like we're providing the capital for the real estate. They provide the ongoing maintenance.
Got it. So, for example, a company like Curaleaf would be the one that owned the property and then send it back. How does that back and forth work from an origin standpoint and then to where it goes?
Yes. So let me kind of take a step back. We are a real estate investment trust that is a classification of a real estate fund that allows us to avoid double taxation as long as we meet the certain rules that Congress has put in place for us. And primarily, it's about distributing our earnings. So as long as we distribute our taxable income, there is no taxation at the corporate level. So it's a very efficient way to gather assets for real estate and invest those assets on behalf of our shareholders. And with respect to the triple net, Curaleaf, the way we accumulate our assets is a Curaleaf, in your example, could have a property that they own and is currently operating, and they could turn around, sell it to us, and then we lease it back immediately. No interruption to the operations. They stay in possession of the building. We transfer paper. We transfer that ownership. Another way we come across our properties is we can purchase properties for our tenants. So as an example, we have a transaction going right now in Missouri with C3, where we had actually acquired the property on their behalf, entered into a lease immediately with them, and then provided capital for the construction of a building. And we could do that for an existing building where maybe we're buying a building and then providing capital for the refurbishment and build out of the building, or we could do a ground up construction. But at the end of the day, each one of these transactions leaves us with a stream of cash flows or rental payments that are 15 to 20 years in duration.
That's awesome. And I've heard this referred to as a sales leaseback before I heard the triple net proper terminology to describe it. And so for our listeners, could you just explain why that is even necessary in the cannabis industry? Like, why, if I was an operator, wouldn't I just go get a loan from a bank? Right? Like, why is this such a popular way to obtain capital for these larger companies?
Yeah. You know, thank you for asking that question, because it's critical to talk about this, because many people think sale leaseback is a cannabis oriented strategy. In fact, sale leaseback transactions are a very regular way approach for companies to fund their real estate capital needs. If you were to look at a Home Depot or a Lowe's or a Walgreens or a Starbucks, these companies, or even a FedEx, these companies all utilize sale leaseback transactions in order to fund their real estate capital needs. So come back to your question, why do they do that? Well, it's inefficient for an organization to raise equity capital and use that capital to invest in a hard asset as real estate. Typically, when you're raising capital, those investors in your company want you to use that capital to grow earnings and to grow EBITDA. And so by and large, you find companies really like to utilize sale leasebacks or leasing in general as an efficient way to look at their capital structure. Now, why has it been maybe more prevalent in the cannabis sector? It's because early on, when the cannabis companies were looking to actually secure locations, they weren't able to secure the real estate necessary for their businesses. So they had to raise excess capital to acquire the properties because they weren't able to lease it for one reason or another. And so therefore, they ended up having large quantities of real estate on their portfolio. And over time, as organizations like ourselves came into play, the companies saw the opportunity to unburden their balance sheet and actually enter into a sale leaseback. Now, let me make one more comment about mortgages. Mortgages are another tool that companies could utilize to provide financing for their real estate capital needs. And we don't think that any one company should look at any one category exclusively. We think there's a place for short-term debt. We think there's a place for mortgage debt. We think there's a place for sale leaseback in coming up with a holistic strategy for capital efficiency, in particular, the way they look at it relative to real estate.
Yeah, that dive is so interesting, especially the way you explained it, because now you think about it, once these companies have to purchase the property in certain states, then they have to invest the capital to get it up and running. And then they need to produce the product. Then they need to sell the product before they can start making any money. Without that, they'd have to raise a ton of cash in order to afford this business. And when we think about it, this is not the only state that they're operating in. So given all these complexities, obviously this makes a big benefit to the market and allows these operators to go forward. So is there certain states that you focus on? Do all states act the same? How does that work?
Yeah, all states definitely don't act the same. And we do have a particular focus in our investment strategy. When we look at our investment strategy, we have three primary components to it. One is obviously the operator and the management team that, and the company's financials that we're looking at. Two is the real estate. We're, of course, looking at the alternative use for the real estate, the real estate's life cycle, and what its alternative use is within cannabis, but also outside of cannabis. And then third, and to your point, it's the jurisdiction that the property is in. cannabis markets are not all made equal, as we all know. We like to look at limited license markets because we think a limited license market, such as in Illinois or Pennsylvania or in Ohio, those more limited license markets provide a better operating environment for the tenant, which means typically better margins, better property level cash flows, which are critically important to get paid rent. Again, remember, these are 15 to 20 year contracts we want to feel confident we could get rent on. And so by focusing on these limited license states, we think our portfolio was really able to weather the difficulties in 2023 across the industry because these businesses had a little bit less competition, a little bit more margin forever, a little bit more EBITDA cushion. And so therefore, when you look at most of the issues in the industry were in, say, California or Colorado or Michigan, those more unlimited license states.
So as the landlord, what kind of compliance do you guys have to meet? Because essentially you're not a plant touching business, but you own the land that has a plant touching business on it. Like, how does that affect your guys' compliance and regulatory aspect? And is there certain states where how the state laws have been drafted, you just don't want to even play in that state?
Well, we do operate in direct contravention of the CSA. Section 856 says that you cannot knowingly rent or lease a property to someone in violation of the Controlled Substances Act. And so we're actively doing that. And it's one of the key issues that's preventing us from getting onto a major exchange like New York and NASDAQ. And in fact, we operate our business to qualify in all respects with a listing on New York or NASDAQ, but for this Section 56 issue. And that's why we're sitting here on the OTC. So that's a critical point for us. In terms of operating state to state to state, no, there's nothing specific in the state statutes that we've come across at this point that would prevent us from going into a state.
Thank you for clarifying.
The joys of cannabis. So when you're looking at states like Missouri, is it location, 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 or is it more like value opportunity, or is it like strategic positioning in regards to going first? How do you balance the three of those?
Quite frankly, it's all of that. And it's indeed what you just said. It is a balance of those items. Let me pull it apart and give you a couple of examples. If we were to be looking at dispensaries in Missouri, we currently own two cultivation facilities for two companies in Missouri. And if we were looking at dispensaries, though, understanding the license structure and understanding the geography of those regions is important. So in St. Louis, right, if you're on the western side of the state, you're in St. Louis. The way the state gave out the licenses and they divided it up the districts, you would end up having roughly 60 licenses around St. Louis. If you were to go to the other side of the state, to Kansas City, the way the counties are laid out there and the resulting number of licenses, you have order of magnitude, roughly 30 licenses. But when you think about Kansas City and the other half of the city is in the state of Kansas, you could get people that would come across the border, you start to see that your addressable market in the Kansas City area is bigger than your addressable market in the St. Louis area, and you have roughly half the competition. So it's those dynamics that you would want to be focused on and understanding around the licensing and the location of a particular property. One other example would be border stores. Some border stores have done very, very well. But as new states come online next to that border, you'll likely see a decrease in sales. And in fact, we've seen that time and again occur when an adjacent state opens up for our medical, but in particular adult use, you'll see significant decrease in sales. And so you just need to underwrite that evolution.
Then how does the balance work with the partners and the MSOs? Because I would assume, I'm just going to make the assumption, that they lean on you as like a scout and understanding locations. Because if you're partnering together in one state, they likely want to have that continuity going forward because you've already done the business, you've vetted them, you've written all the paperwork. So is it a matter of, hey, we've got exposure to three Curaleafs, we want one Trulieve? Or is it more like we prefer to work with this person and we let the highest bidder go and let the market dictate how that goes?
No, another very good question. We definitely are focused on diversification and we're focused on concentration. And so we do want to make sure that to the extent that we are concentrated in a name, it's a name we have extreme confidence in. So if you were to look at our top three tenants today, it would be names such as Curaleaf, Cresco, and Trulieve. And so we get very comfortable with those larger names, particularly in the states that we have properties with them. And so it is important for us to make sure we're doing business with quality companies, but it isn't always that the best companies are public necessarily. We have some private company tenants that would actually give some of the public companies a run for their ability to generate profit and free cash flow after taxes. And so there's some real, real quality private companies that are out there. So just because somebody's public doesn't mean that you automatically get a pass. You certainly have to do your diligence, understand the balance sheet, the P&L, the cash flow statement, as well as the individual facilities and what their long-term strategy is.
Does it allow you, though, if you have a really pristine property that you know is a golden one, to have, like, say, a bidding war against them and say to the operators, hey, we've got this awesome property and Cresco's interested. What do you think, Curaleaf? Do you want to match? Do you want to race? Is it possible to do that, or is that not the type of business that you think it works for?
So one could do that. That is not our business. We don't do development in that way. There are a couple of smaller folks out there that will buy a site, secure a site, get the site entitled to allow for cannabis, and then they'll go out and they'll market it to various operators. We see this happen in Florida a lot around dispensaries. What we have found is that you need a meaningful amount of local knowledge, whether it be ordinances or boards, in order to get approval. And it's just not in our wheelhouse. What we tend to find also is that operators really have a keen sense on where they want to be located, where they want to site their cultivation facility or a dispensary, and they will come to us with the property in mind.
Do you guys have a minimum market size or market cap that the companies that you partner with need to have in terms of revenue that they generate?
No, it de facto becomes somewhat of a minimum when you think about we won't do a startup. The only time we may consider a startup would be an organization that we've had a relationship with for a number of years, or maybe they're on their second or third iteration of being in a cannabis business. But we typically won't do a startup, somebody that's trying to raise capital. We like to know that businesses are operating. We like to know that they've been able to generate cash flow and been able to be successful in the markets they're in. And so with that as a primary screen, and also audited financials, you know, it's interesting. When we first started, I thought it was just a given you would get audited financials, but there are many companies in this industry that don't have that, some of which don't even really appreciate or understand what it means to have audited financials. So when you say you have to have audited financials and some of those other attributes I described, you tend to end up with those that have a bit more substance around the balance sheet, meaning a larger balance sheet size or a larger P&L size.
That makes sense.
Before I got into cannabis, I was unaware that accounting could be creative. I didn't realize that. But in cannabis, there is creative accounting, which is, hey, it works.
See Enron.
Yeah. So we talked about Missouri. We talked about Pennsylvania and Florida. Florida and Pennsylvania are medical markets about to convert. Does that influence at all the positioning aspects of it? Do you have the same consideration? Take us through that thought process.
Yeah, it 100% has an impact on it. You could look at a Virginia right now, and the bill is, as we're recording this, the bill is sitting on Governor Youngkin's desk. And if that bill passes, that'll be a significant boost to the Virginia market. And there's only a few players that are focused on that market. And again, come back to the location of dispensaries. If you think about where Virginia is and you think of its southern border, you can get sales to North Carolina if you're well situated across the southern border. And so for somebody that might be looking for a transaction along that southern border, with North Carolina, that could be very, very attractive if this state flips into an adult use market, or a cultivation facility in Florida, or retail or cultivation in Ohio. I'm really trying to understand what is the unlock for the industry. And quite frankly, you look back at what we did with our friends at C3 in Missouri. We provided them capital to build out during the medical market. And then we had everything in place to provide capital for expansion upon approval of REC. And so when that ballot initiative occurred in November of 22, we very quickly were on the phone with C3, working with them on the expansion, which we've been funding for over the last year, and it's just about to be complete. So exciting to see that get online. But that's my point about understanding the market dynamics, what they could be, and partnering with the tenants to be able to provide that capital they need to take advantage of the market opportunity.
Is it something that your guys are like reactive, meaning that once the bill gets signed, then you kind of put pieces in play to go acquire certain properties? Or is it like, hey, we know it's medical. Eventually it should be rec. Let's go get this property now so that when it does flip, we have it. How does that kind of decision-making process work?
Yeah, that's absolutely part of it. We will look at states. So take Pennsylvania, one of the largest concentrations in our portfolio. We believe that that state will ultimately convert to an adult use market. We just don't know when. Will it be this year? I don't know. Will it be next year? I don't know. But I do believe firmly that it will convert to an adult use market. So we were very comfortable making that one of our largest concentration states. Now, if you were to look at another state that has a small medical market, take Georgia. Right? Very, very tiny, very nascent medical market. But Georgia is a fairly populous state. I don't know that we would take the same position there because it's harder for me to envision Georgia converting to an adult use state anytime soon. Same thing could be said for a Texas, where there were three operators in Texas. And there were some deals that had been done a couple of years ago in Texas. We stayed away from it because our view was this is a really small medical market. We haven't even seen the legislature have interest in expanding the medical market, let alone trying to position capital there for an ultimate conversion to adult use. So we definitely are looking at that expected timeline for conversion.
Are there any markets we're not thinking about that your team is saying, hey, like if things change here, this could be an opportunity to put some exposure? Or is there anything you can share about that?
I think we've hit on a couple of them. I mean, if the obvious ones are Ohio and Florida. Again, Florida, even without adult use, is a terrific market. It's a large and growing market. When it does get adult use, and we believe it will, it's going to be a phenomenal market, one of the largest in the world. We touched on Virginia. I think also, you know, if you think about some of the smaller markets, some of the best properties that we see across this industry tend to be in the more rural areas where there's less competition. Particularly on the dispensary side. So people shouldn't ignore markets like a Connecticut. It's a smaller market, gets less attention, but folks can be really competitive there. You know, not a lot's being talked about New Jersey lately. New Jersey is a very, very populous state that we think still has some room to run in terms of its growth. You know, the interesting part of this for us over the last year has been watching mature states like a Michigan and a Massachusetts, watching those states actually grow sales as pricing comes down. And it makes a ton of sense when you think about it. As the price point comes down and it becomes more price competitive with the illicit market, individuals or consumers switch their buying habits from the illicit market to the legal channel. And you're converting those sales to the legal channel and you're watching those legal sales accelerate and grow into what we would have thought were already saturated markets. And so even in some of these markets, like in Illinois that went to adult use a few years ago, even that market we think has some real growth ahead of it as you watch more dispensaries get open, and that leads to greater access, greater competition, which brings down the price point. So as long as companies can manage the margin compression that comes along with that in an appropriate way, I think it's a very healthy evolution of the marketplace.
Have you guys looked at any international markets or land in international places? I know Curaleaf.
I can't say that we've evaluated international markets. I can't say that we've looked at specific properties. The way we think about it is our opportunity set here in the U.S. is so significant that we should be squarely focused here on the U.S. If one of our tenants has an international property that they'd like us to take a look at, for sure, we will evaluate it. Our chairman of the board runs an international real estate business. So we have that experience within the organization, so we could certainly look at it, but we would probably only do that in the near term in a partnership approach, really meeting a need of an existing tenant, as opposed to going out and looking for deals in some of those other foreign jurisdictions.
One of the things that gets thrown around often is the cannabis tax. Does your team, when you're negotiating for the property, still face that?
It's less and less. When we first started this company back in 2018, 2019, we were hearing 20, 25% property taxes for not actual taxes, but as you said, the cannabis tax, the green tax to acquire these properties. We are actually seeing that get less and less. I'd say, you know, is it 5% now or less? It's probably in that zip code.
What about tenants not paying their rent? Obviously, they're not paying their tax. Excuse me. A lot of them are rumored to not paying taxes. And I'm curious to know if in that same breath, they decide, hey, not going to pay our landlord just because we got to make hard decisions. And in those aspects, they have to prioritize certain areas to pay first.
Yeah. Yeah. So this comes back down to our underwriting. And one of the elements that I mentioned earlier was this focus on property level cash flows. We look at what's called EBITDAR, that is EBITDA plus rent. And what we're trying to calculate there is the amount of cash flow that a property could generate for the tenant. If a property can generate significant cash flow for the tenant, they'll continue paying their rent because these are critical use facilities. And without them, they can't generate cash flow. They can't generate profit for their shareholders. And so it all starts with underwriting the property and underwriting those property level cash flows. But even if you do that, such as we did and we experienced in 2023, there are periods of time where you will have tenant difficulties and they can't meet a rental payment. And that's not just for cannabis-oriented businesses. Any net lease business, any sale leaseback company, when you're underwriting 15 to 20 year rent payments, you're bound to have issues within the portfolio. And for us, out of our transactions, we've only had one property that wasn't able to pay full rent last year. We worked with the tenant. We came to a settlement in early fourth quarter. We were able to recover some of our back due rent. They had liquidity issues. And again, I go back to that EBITDAR coverage. That property and that company can make money. They had liquidity issues that were born out of their cultivation facility, one of the larger wholesalers in the state of Massachusetts. Their liquidity issues happened to exactly coincide with a significant and rapid drop in pricing that impacted margins. So it was I don't want to call it a perfect storm, but a real confluence of negative events that impacted them. They were able to get through it. They were able to raise some incremental capital, bring in some new management, and we came to that agreement in the fourth quarter. And in the fourth quarter, we collected 100% of rent from all of our tenants. We also have 100% of our properties are being leased right now, which we're really proud of because all of our capital is being put to work for our investors.
Is that something where you guys work through that situation in real time? Or is it like where you guys don't find out until like almost the end of Q4 where they're like, hey, we can't really, Anthony, I can't write you that check. Like, we got to figure something out? Or is it something where you kind of can feel the temperature of the water as the whole situation's kind of unfolding?
Yeah, we spend a lot of time following our tenants, dialoguing with our tenants. And what I will say is that with the regular reporting that we require under our lease agreements and the financials that we require, you often can get a sense for, is an organization trending up or down relative to sales, cash flow. We also are very much in these markets and we hear a lot about our tenants. And so you could get a sense for it. I can't say that we knew exactly to the day that there was going to be an issue, but we could see that there were issues. And through the regular dialogue with our tenants, we learn about cultivation issues, or we learn about production issues or testing issues. And so you have a sense for it. And I was saying this through the end of 22 into 23 on our earnings calls. I was telling our investors, it's just a matter of time until we have an issue in the portfolio. And so judge us by how prepared we are and judge us by how we resolve that in order to get the best net present value for our shareholders, as opposed to actually having it. Because we always knew from the inception of the company that there would be an issue in the portfolio. And that's why we did certain things in the structure of our leases, like cross-collateralizing security deposits on multi-property transactions. We also cross-default leases. And so why you do that is because if somebody has a property that's operating well and a property that's not operating well, they can't say, well, I'm not going to pay here and I'll pay you there. Well, you don't pay on one, and we have the lever to default across all. So you do things like that to get prepared. So we always knew the day would come. We were prepared and we took a real collaborative approach with the tenant. They were able to raise some incremental capital with the concessions that we were able to provide. And we think we've got a credit quality tenant that that will serve our investors well as we continue on with that tenant and that property.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important. And I think exactly as you alluded to, that sometimes just the winds blow the wrong way and people kind of get caught in a short-term situation where maybe some things go wrong and some partners don't pay them directly and they've just kind of got to hold up in cash. So is there a significant modeling that goes on internally from understanding, let's say, the wholesale price and then working through some of those? Is it that detailed or is it more macro level of like, here's how the industry looks from Missouri standpoint, here's how it looks like in Maryland, and then the balance between the two?
It's an insightful question, and it is extremely detailed. I'm sure our team, when they see this, they'll be chuckling to themselves. We monitor pricing very closely. We underwrite what we think a market will do. We have our own modeling for how we think a market's pricing will evolve. Yes, we get third parties who are experts in this to provide their input and we buy their data, but we come up with our own modeling based on what we know across all the markets that we participate in, and even markets we don't participate in. We study them very closely, and we're always taking haircuts off of projections because we always know that pricing will compress. I mean, the fact that pricing compressed across the industry last year wasn't surprising to us. And not to say that we're super smart. It just made rational sense that as you have increased competition, you will have a decrease in pricing. It also made a lot of sense that when you saw companies raising significant capital in 2021 to build out capacity, both from the manufacturing as well as the distribution side, you knew there would be more competition. For us, the surprise was the severity of the price decline and the swiftness with which it happened. And so we're always modeling in price declines into our underwriting because we know that over time, this industry will become commoditized. And in order for it to really truly get at its addressable market and its true capacity, we know that the ultimate price point has to come down to broaden out consumer participation.
That's when the scenario planning is fun, but also really, really scary because you're like, if it hits these numbers, then all the red lights go off.
Is there a DS factor in the hemp industry and like Delta 8 pricing and now I guess hemp derived Delta 9 pricing into the models as well?
Yeah, we talk about it very hard though. Go ahead.
No, I was wondering because it sounds really complex how you would integrate those data points into the model to try to provide insight into how it's going to affect the cannabis industry.
Yeah, this is a real issue for the industry. As I know you guys know it. And there's really is no reliable data that we've been able to come across that can truly size how these products are impacting sales on a market by market basis. I really do hope that the government closes down in the farm bill, closes down this loophole. I think the industry is suffering, not just in sales, but from a reputational perspective, looking at some of these products and how it's resulting in adverse outcomes in minors and not even minors, in people who are of age and for adults. All that's negative. And I think the general public, they can't really discern between the licensed product and the unlicensed product. They really don't have enough information or enough knowledge about the sector to do that. So all the bad stuff that happens from the hemp-derived products, and I don't want to paint the entire industry with a bad brush, but it's pretty obvious that there's some negative stuff that's occurring from it in the unregulated market. And in fact, it makes more of a point for why we should have a regulated market around these products. So I'm hopeful that the federal government will close this loophole. Come back to your question. We consider it, but we don't have reliable data where we could yet work it into the models that we have.
I'm sure that's not the only unreliable data point you have. Maybe the illicit market too kind of plays into another unknown and wondering like, if this continues on this path, will we lose various operators, which then could send the price in X, Y, and Z? Kind of like what we've seen in California, where the price has kind of been up and down and then really severely down.
Yes. But what's interesting about when you look at the chart for California or Colorado or some of the other states, you do see the volatility, but it's a fascinating lesson in economics. You do see the rationalization in the chart where pricing comes down, capacity goes down, but then pricing starts to come back because the supply is low, right? So then, and the demand is still there. So the pricing comes back. Then you have people say, well, I can make money at that price. So the supply comes back in, then the pricing goes down because it's a little over. So it takes a while for that market to find its equilibrium. And I think we're actually seeing that play out in California. And these aren't factors that can actually work themselves through in a matter of weeks. This takes months and quarters to work its way through. And so that supply-demand dynamic, I think, will create a more stable environment over time.
That's how they should have.
Do you think that eventually we'll see, granted, there's no federal legalization, but eventually we'll see kind of the price point stabilize in every single state market to almost a similar price point? Or do you think that cannabis in one state will always be more expensive than cannabis in another state?
Well, I won't say always because, you know, that's I won't speak in absolutes. That's way, way long time. I'd say in the near term, I expect that we will maintain these state structures, and that those state structures will result in disparities between pricing from state to state. I think you'll find clusters of states. So for instance, where Brian and I are here in the Northeast, there's such a congestion or a concentration, I should say, of population amongst a group of states, say New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, that I think over time they will have to find some equilibrium. But the difficulty there is you're going to need harmonization around some licensing. You're going to need harmonization around taxation in order to ultimately get there. So I don't see it actually happening across the country in the near or intermediate term. I think we're going to have this state construct for, you know, probably the next 5 to 8 years at least. And then my crystal ball doesn't go out beyond that.
Are there any facts or statistics about the cannabis industry that most wouldn't know?
We touched on it. And it's this concept of markets that you already thought were saturated or were already at, call it, peak cannabis volume. As the price point comes down to the consumer, you see this extra leg of growth occur. And we've observed it now in Michigan as well as in Massachusetts. And so people think that, oh, we've hit a plateau in sales. But actually, as that price comes down, I think you get a leg up in volumes. And so as long as companies can manage that price compression and the margin compression well, and really play into the volume game, I think there's some real profit opportunities out there for those. And we've seen companies that can navigate those dynamics well and profit from it.
Do you think that that is potentially related to increased consumers adopting the plant over the course of the maturity of the market in those states?
There's a little bit of that, but I believe more of what it is current purchasing activity that's in the illicit market moving to the newly price competitive legal channel. I don't know that we've yet tapped into the canna-curious or the cannabis entrant consumer. We're getting certainly some of that. I don't think that's the bulk of what's driving the dynamic I described. But what you touch on is another leg in growth that this industry is going to get as we get more normalization and ultimately as we get legalization. I don't know about you guys, but you've probably seen over the last few weeks with all the noise around cannabis in the news, whether it be the vice president's confab at the White House or some of the noise out of Washington, D.C., I'm certainly hearing the dialogue more and more, not just within the circle of people I speak to, but overhearing it at a restaurant or overhearing it walking down the street.
Yeah, most of the people that refer to it here can smell it. And that's their reference on how Evelyn is. But I wonder, too, like with all the catalysts on the horizon, how do those influence your business?
You know, for us, we think there's a real need long term for real estate in the cannabis industry, no matter what state you're in. So we know that there's demand for capital around real estate, both cultivation and retail, which again, if you look at our portfolio, we're almost half and half in terms of the number of properties, but roughly 92% of our capital is in cultivation facilities. Makes sense because they just cost more. You have a $20 to $30 million cultivation facility and $1 to $2 million dispensary. So we think there's going to continue to be demand. When we think about how this industry evolves, we do believe that these state constructs continue to be prevalent for as far as at least our eye can see. And so we think that organizations are going to need to replicate their infrastructure, both cultivation and distribution, on a state-by-state basis. So that's just going to drive more demand for real estate capital. When we reach a world where you have interstate commerce, which we think is way off into the future, it's also going to be a time where you have legalization. Like, that's where interstate commerce can happen, when you have legalization. When you have legalization, the addressable market for this product explodes, in our opinion. And so in that world where the industry will need a rapid scale up to meet the rapid new demand, we think that organizations will just need more real estate capital in order to build out capacity to meet that robust demand. So we think there's a great opportunity for us to continue our focus on limited license states with high quality operators that have proven their ability to generate profit and cash flow. So that's what we're going to be focused on.
Would your team ever consider being an M&A vehicle for, let's say, two of the bigs kind of coming together if you have a good underwriting of both of the assets together? And then would that be something you'd consider?
Well, we have a lot of M&A background. You know, I was a banker and some other folks that are involved in the business were as well. What we have seen over the last few years is when people are talking about combining their businesses, sometimes that business has owned real estate in it. And they will come and they'll talk to us about executing a sale leaseback transaction concurrent with the M&A to create cash at closing so that some of the consideration can be cash as opposed to just stock. It's not as dilutive if they can use some cash for the consideration in the transaction. So in that context, would we ever introduce folks that we know? We do that all the time. I'd say it's less and less these days because everybody tends to know each other. There's less exploratory conversations, if you will. But we would, we're not looking to be an M&A shop. We're looking really to just build relationships, help people succeed, because if our tenants are successful, we're going to be successful.
What question do you wish more people asked you?
Why is your stock so undervalued? I think that's been an underappreciated, it's a very self-serving question, but you asked it. I think until recently, people looked at New Lake and they either weren't sure what we did or they didn't know enough about our business to ask about the undervaluation and or where can I buy your stock? And so what we've done this quarter is we actually have a page on our website that lists out where people can buy our stock since it's OTC listed, since we're cannabis adjacent. It's often difficult, as we all know, around custody. And so we have that page on our site. That's been helpful. But we've also added some information this most recent quarter into our investor deck, highlighting that valuation discount to our peers. And I think that's been helpful to educating investors about our company.
Are you guys affected by 280E at all?
Indirectly, yes.
I mean, but you pay out dividends, right?
So, we pay dividends, but we're not taxed. And so we're not subject to 280E. But we're indirectly impacted because our tenant base, we estimate our tenant base would save over $200 million of taxes amongst them. And think about that for a minute. It's one of the catalysts that we've been talking about in this deck. We put these catalysts in there, right? We're highlighting this for investors. We've been talking about it for months now, is the credit quality improvement of our entire portfolio goes up overnight with the elimination of 280E. There are very few REITs out there that have a single catalyst that elevates the credit quality of the entire portfolio upon one action. So we think we're going to get two benefits from it. Number one is what I just talked about, increased cash flow for our tenants, which makes them a better credit quality. But we also believe that we'll see equity values go up for the sector. With that appreciation in equity values, we certainly expect some of the operators to recapitalize their balance sheet, i.e. issue equity and pay down debt. When you do that, you improve the credit quality of that tenant further because they're reducing their debt load. They're improving their cash flow by reducing interest expense that they have to pay. So you have a better capitalized tenant, better cash flow tenant, and it gets into that positive feedback loop. And so we think Schedule 280E, while not directly impacting us as a tax matter, really improves the credit quality of our tenants over time.
Yeah, that was really important. I'm appreciative that you shared that.
Thank you.
All right, Anthony, prediction time. With major potential adult use markets on the horizon like Florida and Pennsylvania, how does New Lake plan to capitalize on the evolving market dynamics to be at the forefront of the next major wave?
Yeah, it's one word, relationships. What we've been trying to do over the past 5+ years in this business is build relationships and have a quality reputation that we can work with tenants successfully to accomplish their needs. It seems pretty straightforward when you say, oh, we're going to provide a sale leaseback transaction. But I could tell you most transactions have a nuance, whether it's a particular build out nuance, whether there's a licensing nuance, there's always something to it. And what we like to think of ourselves as is partners to these tenants, working through those issues, figuring out a way for them to be long-term successful. Because I said it before, our tenants' success will ultimately be our success. And so as we look at these states, we understand the landscape of players out there, and most of them know us. And so what we want to do is continue to put ourselves out there as one of the organizations that has capital to invest, that can be a good long-term partner for any of the businesses that are looking for capital in these particular states. And so for us, we'll keep our head down, keep building relationships, sound underwriting, and continue to pay out a quarterly dividend to our shareholders.
Dylan, take a swing.
I think I'm going to agree. I mean, network is going to be really important for New Lake moving forward. I also think that just patience, probably, right? Which clearly you guys have demonstrated that from the last 4 years, right? Or 5 years. And so I think patience is huge because there's been a lot of like volatility and growth at all costs and now pull back and like capital in. Now there's no capital. Like there's been a lot of this volatility and just being patient and kind of letting the storm pass, if you will. You will be probably the best place for New Lake to be standing in 3 to 5 years, in my opinion. What do you think, Brian?
I think experience really matters. And I think exactly like Anthony was alluding to today, understanding the different market dynamics and where to position their assets, but also where to go faster will help them accelerate in the new direction. Because exactly like you said today, that there's certain states that you really want to be really populous, like Pennsylvania, but there's others that may change the regulatory aspects in the future that may dictate a change in strategy, where then your team, based on its understanding and likely its modeling, which Kellen and I would love to see one day, which I'm sure you can't share, but are interested. I think that will show those opportunity points that could really be beneficial in the future.
Yeah. And if you were to dial back since our IPO, what we always talked about was not just growth, but we use the phrase quality growth. We don't want to grow just for growth's sake. We want to have quality growth. And while these deals are never easy, it's easier to close a transaction than it is to collect the rent for 15 to 20 years. And so the hard work of being able to collect the rent happens on the front end doing the quality underwriting. And so just putting up a transaction to be able to tell the market that we had a bunch of growth and then a year or two from now, we can't collect the rent, really doesn't do anything for our shareholders, just creates volatility and uncertainty. We'd rather be slow, steady, quality.
Perfect. And that 100% really definitely stands strong. Love it. So Anthony, for our listeners, they want to get in touch, they want to buy New Lake stock, where can they find you?
NewLake.com. On our investor page, there is a how to buy our stock tab. We're listed on the OTC under the ticker symbol NLCP.
Awesome. We'll link it all up in the show notes. Thanks for taking the time. This was a lot of fun.
Guys, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise.
Guys, if you've enjoyed this podcast over the last few years, can you please take 3 minutes or less and leave us a quick review on Apple or Spotify? All reviews make a massive difference for us and help other people like you find this podcast. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hi, my name's Kate, and I'm your host of the Pot Moms podcast. I started the Pot Moms podcast, well, because I wanted to end the stigma against using cannabis, specifically with moms, but also anyone who chooses to consume. I strive for a balance of humor and education, along with some pretty rad guests, to help combat social biases that come with consuming cannabis. Kids are hard. Join me for regular podcast episodes packed with parenting hacks, real-life stories, and of course, my favorite cannabis products. The days are long, but the years are short. So roll another J and take a deep breath. Keep blazing and stay amazing.